Okay, good morning everyone. We start this morning session. The speaker is, again, Professor Chivukula from Michigan State University. The topic is deconstruction and the Texas model. Okay.
Thank you very much. So, good morning. So my task today is to build on the framework that we built yesterday. I'm going to discuss, can you hear me in the back? No? Better? Okay. I'm going to discuss Higgs-less models, particularly in the context of deconstruction. So I'm going to go through what deconstruction is. I'm going to talk about the analysis of Higgs-less models in some generality. And by the end, I hope to get to the stage where Professor Simmons will give an example of a simple Higgs-less model tomorrow in greater detail. So deconstruction, so to remind you where we were discussing Higgs-less models, and we saw that a Higgs-less model was, in the continuum at least, was a five-dimensional gauge theory on some kind of a compactified or warped space with boundary conditions on the interval of the compact space, such that the spectrum of the theory included a massless photon, light, vector bosons that could be associated with the W and the Z, although we didn't talk in great detail about how to actually couple fermions, which is how you would tell that they act like Ws and Zs. And then a tower of states that are substantially more massive, whose purpose is to, at least in the interim, to unitarize WW scattering and play the role that the Higgs boson would in the standard model. In that sense, unitarization is achieved, or at least delayed, without the presence of a fundamental scalar part. Now, when we left it, this was kind of the recipe for a Higgs-less model. We had to choose what gauge group we were going to deal with in five dimensions. We had to choose how the gauge coupling varied in the fifth dimension. Again, since we've eliminated translational invariance in the fifth dimension, there's no reason that the gauge coupling couldn't vary with the position in the fifth dimension. We have to choose the manifold and the metric on which the theory is compactified. Then given these three choices, we have to calculate the spectrum. Remember, we get a wave equation for the modes in the extra dimension, just like in the Fourier series example that we did last time. We have to calculate the spectrum and the eigenfunctions corresponding to that. We have to calculate the fermion couplings, and from that we can extract the ST and U parameters. And in principle, we could do this an infinite number of times. Now, just to remind you, Professor Tanabashi already showed this. This is one way of defining the four relevant electroweak parameters, the four non-decoupling electroweak parameters as he described, S, T, delta rho, and delta, and they come in as corrections to the neutral current and charge current scattering amplitudes. And that was equivalent to a definition of parameters given by Barbieri. Now, so in principle, what one has to do is compute the spectrum and the eigenfunctions of the Higgs-less model, calculate the fermion couplings, and then compare the tree-level predictions in the Higgs-less model to this general framework and extract what the values of S and T and delta rho are. Now, given that there are so many different choices and potentially that one could make for these three things, what the bulk gauge group is, what the coupling is, and what the metric is, it seems like there's a lot to do and that, you know, this is an endless task. Now, on the one hand, that's a good thing. That's a full employment program for theorists. On the other hand, it's a bad thing because we'd like to know the answer because we're kind of impatient. And it turns out that you can actually do much better than that. You can analyze this entire class of theories all at the same time. And that's what I want to describe to you today. The method for analyzing these two theories all at once actually relies on a slightly different construction that's somewhat easier to explain, the calculation is somewhat easier to explain using deconstruction. Deconstruction, as illustrated here, is taking something that's continuous and breaking it up into little pieces and putting it back together in such a way that the pieces approximate the whole. And in principle, by breaking it up into smaller and smaller pieces and being a little more careful in how you actually put it together, you can get a better and better approximation to the continuum picture. So, in principle, if we can do, I'll be much more precise about this in the next slide, but in principle, if we can analyze Higgs-less models in the deconstructed limit, then as long as there's a well-defined way in which to connect the deconstructed to the continuum limit, then having analyzed it in full generality in the deconstructed picture, we actually will have answers that carry over on into the full five-dimensional picture as well. In fact, in many ways, I prefer the deconstructed language because from the point of view of deconstruction, as we'll see, these Higgsless models turn out to be nothing other than simple four-dimensional extended electroweak gauge symmetries of a kind that we've often studied. They may be a bit more complicated, but there are actually certain regularities and patterns which allow us to make a lot of progress in general. Okay, so enough of pretty pictures. Let's actually try to figure out what's going on. The basic idea of deconstruction is, I'm not entirely sure this is actually a word in the English language, but is to latticize the fifth dimension. So here's the interval, say, in the fifth dimension that we want in the continuum, and transverse to that fifth dimension are all the infinite four-dimensional space that we're talking about. And instead of having a continuum of different points along here, we could restrict our attention to a certain number of discrete points along the fifth direction. Okay? So we replace what was a full five-dimensional theory instead with a set along each of these planes, you have a different four-dimensional gauge theory. Because if you think about it for a second, if you fix the coordinate x5 and move along the transverse direction, the degrees of freedom you have correspond to a full four-dimensional gauge theory. And in fact, warping and everything is possible as well, because really the key has to do with how the gauge theory, say, on this first point couples to the gauge theory on the second point. Okay. So deconstruction has to do with, it comprises replacing the continuous fifth dimension with a discrete number of points. And to do so in a way that you can recover the continuum limit so that naively as you add more and more and more points, you recover the full continuum five-dimensional field theory. And the calculations that I'll try to walk you through today will be able to do the calculations in principle of ST, delta rho, and delta for an arbitrary deconstructed gauge theory in a particular class, which will allow us to infer information about the whole class of Higgsless models. So how does that actually work in detail? Well, the simplest way to describe it involves a notation called Moose notation, and that's Moose notation. I will describe that in greater detail in the next slide. So each of these circles represents one of the lattice points in the fifth dimension. And each of the circles represents a four-dimensional gauge theory at that lattice point. Okay? Now those four-dimensional gauge theories can have different coupling constants. Those coupling constants are given by these coupling constants here, g0, g1, up to gn plus 1. And it turns out there's a dimensionful parameter, which will be defined more precisely on the next few slides, which relates the couplings, which tells you how to couple the gauge theory at this side with the gauge theory at that side. Okay? And all of the issue of warping has to do with the parameters of these dimensionful parameters that relate the interactions between the adjacent four-dimensional theory. Now, what I will show you in at least some specificity in the next few slides is that by adjusting the values of these coupling constants and these F parameters in the appropriate way as the number of such sites goes to infinity, you can recover any warped five-dimensional gauge theory or flat five-dimensional gauge theory you want on an with an arbitrary method. So this line corresponds to the discretized fifth dimension. The points along it correspond to the lattice points in the fifth dimension. There's a four-dimensional gauge group at each site. And the interactions between the adjacent sites turn out to be nonlinear sigma models, as we'll see in the next slide. So I have to describe Moose notation. As my advisor would say, it was called Moose notation for obscure historical reasons that no one remembers. But the name has stuck, unless you're a string theorist, in which case you have to come up with a different name for everything, and so they call it quiver theory instead. So Moose notation is a simple way of writing down gauge groups, product gauge groups, and the symmetry breaking pattern amongst those product gauge groups. So let's take a very simple example. SU2 cross U1 breaks to U1. That's the standard electroweak theory that we're all used to. In Moose notation, this would correspond to an SU2 group at one site and a U1 group at an adjacent site. And the link field coupling to these two is exactly, it provides the Goldstone bosons. It's the electroweak chiral Lagrangian that Professor Tanabashi discussed, which couples the SU2 at this side to the U1 at this side. Now, the way this notation works, this dashed line here actually indicates that in the limit that this coupling G prime goes to zero, this is a full SU2 global symmetry. And so this is a nonlinear signal model which breaks SU2 left across SU2 right down to SU2 vector, just as Professor Tanabashi explained in detail. And only the T3 component, only the U1 component of this group is gauged. Of course, whether you call it T3 or something else is a gauge, is a choice of vacuum. And this nonlinear signal model link connects this group to this group, and the only unbroken group is the subgroup T3 plus hypercharge. Okay? So the standard model in Nusse notation looks just like this. But you can see now, by repeating this pattern many times, we can talk about an arbitrary product group structure and a symmetry breaking pattern in which the groups are broken down in various ways. So let's take a somewhat more complicated example. This is a kind of theory that has been discussed in many different contexts, including the ununified standard model, non-commuting extended technicolor, top flavor, etc. Suppose you had a gauge group which was SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 cross U1, which at some high scale breaks to SU2 cross U1, where this SU2 is the diagonal sum of these two, and this U1 is the diagonal sum of these two. And then at some lower scale breaks to the ordinary electromagnetism. Okay? Now, many different kinds of groups in the literature, many different kinds of theories, models in the literature actually follow this pattern. This would be nicely and compactly summarized by this kind of a Moose notation here. Here's the theory, SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 cross U1. And the link fields do exactly what we say. This link field couples SU2 left and SU2 weak at a scale which here, in more generality, we've chosen to call it F over cosine alpha, but ignore the cosine alpha for the moment. Here, on this side, there's a nonlinear sigma model. This is a pretty trivial nonlinear sigma model. It's a U1 cross U1 mod U1 sigma model. It has not many degrees of freedom at all. This one breaks these two U1s down to hypercharge at a scale proportional to F. And then, lower down, here's the interaction that breaks the overall SU2 cross U1 to U1. Now, this is not the most general such thing. There are different ways you could write down this Moose. Here, we've chosen to take the lightest BEV, if you want, to couple to these two groups. Okay, there are different choices you could make, but each of them would correspond to a different kind of a Moose that you could write down. But this is a simple one. And this is the one, actually, that most people consider. This also gives us a way of talking about, for example, how fermion couplings arise. Because if we want to know how to calculate the fermion couplings to the electroweak group or to U1, we actually need to know where their couplings derive from the full unbroken gauge theory that you started with. So in most cases, what we would do is take the SU2 properties to arise from this side and the U1 properties to arise from this side. Okay? And this has certain nice properties that you can show. For example, you can show the row parameter is always 1 and tree level. You could show that in the limit f goes to infinity, that recovers the standard model. So each of these link fields is a nonlinear signal model of that sort. But notice that there's a very definite structure to this. Although we're talking about in principle an infinite class of different kinds of models, because we can vary the coupling constants and we can vary the F constants. There is a certain regularity to this, right? They all lie on a straight line. They're all adjacent couplings. The gauge theory at this site only couples to the gauge theory at this site, not to the one at this site. Okay. So this is often called theory space, because looking at it this way, there's absolutely no reason to think of this as a fifth dimension at all. All it is an extended electroweak symmetry. It's a four-dimensional gauge theory with many, many different factors. Only in the limit where you recover, where you go to n goes to infinity, would you even conceive of thinking of that index as an extra dimension. So we can think of this, as is often referred to as theory space, and there are many things you could do in theory space. You could add extra links if you want, a couple groups that are not next, one site next to the other. We're not going to discuss those examples. Those would correspond to generalizations of the pattern of models that we're talking about right now. So as I say, warping, as we'll see on the next slide, corresponds to varying the Fs. For spatially dependent couplings, we can vary the g's. We can take n goes to infinity. And this kind of a construction was pointed out by these two groups. So let's see how the continuum limit works in a little bit greater detail so you can actually can be convinced that possibly this has some sense at all. Okay, so let's write down the Lagrangian corresponding to this model. Well, there's a sum of gauge kinetic terms. Here's the sum of gauge kinetic terms, one for every site. So we've written it down in the normalization that the kinetic energies of the gauge bosons have a 1 over g squared. It's a convenient notation. Here are the n plus 1 nonlinear. So there are n plus 2 gauge groups and n plus 1 nonlinear sigma model. Here are the order p squared couplings between the adjacent groups in the link fields. So there are a bunch. There's a nonlinear sigma model field here corresponding to f constant f1. That's the first term in this sum. And I'm calling the nonlinear sigma model u. Unfortunately, I call it u here and sigma here. Sorry about that. But there's a U2, a U3, up to UN plus 1. Now, we actually know a lot about how this theory is going to look in the end. Let's, for the moment, consider all of these to be SU2 groups. That's actually going to be pretty close to what we're considering in the end. If they're all SU2s, we know that the overall coupling, so there's going to be one unbroken SU2. Since each of these link fields breaks down the adjacent groups to the diagonal sum, there's one unbroken gauge group at low energy, so it corresponds to the diagonal sum of the currents from all of these different groups. That's what it helps us do. And we know exactly how its coupling constant behaves. 1 over the coupling of the unbroken group squared is the sum of 1 over the coupling squares of each of the groups. That's just the generalization of what happens in SU2 plus U1, where we say 1 over E squared is 1 over G squared plus 1 over G prime squared. And this generalizes the arbitrary. So I'm going to write each of these couplings as this unbroken coupling G times the square root of n, the 2 is just there for normalization, and then some factor kappa sub I. So I've taken all of the variability in the coupling constants and I've moved it over here into this kappa. Now, what may not be as familiar to you is that harmonic sum dependence is 1 over f squared. The 1 over g, sum of 1 over g squared, actually has a sense in which it works for the f constants as well. I'll actually describe a physical picture for why that happens later on. But there is a sense in which the overall f constant left over at low energies, that's relevant at low energies, is 1 over the sum of the f squares of each of the f constants of each of these nonlinear sigma models. And as I say, I'll describe later a physical picture for why that's true. So I'm going to do the same thing to the f constants. I'm going to call these f sub i's this overall low energy f times the square root of n plus 1 times some h. And so all of the variabilities in the f's are now ascribed in terms of the h's. Finally, I'm going to define a continuum coordinate, right? If I take n to infinity, what I have to tell you is how I'm going to adjust all the coupling constants, how I'm going to adjust all the f's, and how I'm going to reproduce the parameterization of the fifth dimension. So I'm going to define a dimensionless coordinate, which eventually I'm going to think of as the coordinate in the fifth dimension, as I over n plus 1. So this is at y equals 0, this is at y equals 1 over n plus 1, 2 over n plus 1, et cetera, up to y equals 1 over here. And so in the continuum limit, these y's becomes a continuous parameter going from 0 to 1, and the interval that I'm going to be describing, I'm just parameterizing the coordinates that go from this one. So I'm going to take f, g, and these constants here, kappa I and h sub I, to be finite in the n goes to infinity limit. That's the way in which I'm going to take the continuum limit. So kappa, instead of being a discrete set of numbers, becomes a function of y. H, instead of being a discrete set of numbers that are bounded, just becomes a function of y, which is well-behaved. But the actual g's and the f's actually go to infinity exactly as the square root of n, as n gets lower. Now the last thing I need to point out before we go to the next page and you see how the miracle of deconstruction works, is that if you actually look at this derivative here for a nonlinear sigma model, for the jth site somewhere in the middle here, It's a derivative on the link field use of J, and it transforms with a gauge field on the left-hand side and a gauge field on the right-hand side. That's because the nonlinear sigma model field transforms under the two groups adjacent to that particular lesson. Now, if you think about it for a moment, if these are all, say, SU2 groups, and these are all SU2 plus SU2 nonlinear sigma models, I can choose a gauge so that this link is the identity, this link is the identity, this link is the identity, etc. I can go to unitary gauge, where I get rid of all the Goldstone bosons in this four-dimensional picture. In the five-dimensional language, that's like going to an axial gauge, as we'll see. That's like taking A5 equal to 0. In that gauge, where all of these link fields are 0, these covariant derivatives simply become differences of A's at adjacent sites. But that's kind of nice. Differences of A's at different sites in the continuum limit is going to be related to a derivative in the fifth dimension of the five-dimensional gauge field. Because as I take n to infinity, the index, A mu sub j, is going to become A mu as a function not only of the four spatial coordinates, but also of the compact coordinate y in the n goes to infinity limit. And this difference is going to be related to a derivative with respect to y. That's it. That's essentially the key. So this is how the continuum limit works. In the n goes to infinity limit, as I said, the y sub i's become a continuous variable y. The difference in adjacent y's, 1 over n plus 1, just goes to the infinitesimal dy. 1 over n plus 1 times the sum over the sites just becomes the Riemann integral from 0 to 1. The a mu sub j, as I said, goes to a mu of x and y, that what was a discrete coordinate, a discrete coordinate j, discrete index j, becomes a continuum coordinate y. And, as I said, this difference between adjacent sites divided by delta y, which is where this n plus 1 comes from, becomes the derivative of a mu with respect to y. Okay. And the normalization conditions here, these normalization conditions, actually give you certain normalization conditions on the kappa i's go to a continuum variable kappa sub y. These had to do with the coupling constants. The h's had to do with the f constants. And these normalizations turn out to be normalizations on the kappa and the y. Then if you look at this Lagrangian and take and plug in this continuum limit, this is what you find. What was a sum over adjacent sites becomes an integral over dy. What was the sum over the different gauge kinetic terms, 1 over g sub I squared, f I squared, becomes a five-dimensional, a piece of the five-dimensional f mu nu squared. It's not everything, because in five dimensions, you would have not only f mu nu, but also f mu y. But the f mu y piece comes from here, in unity. So everything goes over. This form of the Lagrangian is exactly what you would have gotten just for a five-dimensional gauge theory. Okay? Notice that because of the anti-symmetry of the field strength, there's no FYY. So I didn't have to get that term wrong. And so everything then reduces to this. So this is almost exactly what you would have expected, except that there's a difference between what multiplies this term and what multiplies that term. That's it. Was I more careful about it? Yeah. But if you remember what a five-dimensional Yang-Mills Lagrangian should be, for an arbitrary metric, there should be a square root of the metric times this factor here. So there are factors of the metric that come in, and the factors of the metric distinguish between the different components of the S. And so this Lagrangian here actually corresponds to a five-dimensional gauge theory in terms of this metric. Okay? So you can reproduce any metric that you want. And in fact, there's a certain amount of ambiguity in how I do it, because I didn't have to choose this to be my coordinate. This was just a choice for my coordinate. There are many different choices for the coordinate that I could make. With this choice of coordinate, it turns out that everything goes into the metric itself. That the coupling constant appears to be a constant everywhere, and that all of the factors arise from the metric. Now, if you look at it in detail, this looks like a kind of a funny metric because it's got dimension. It's a dimensionless metric. That's because I've chosen a dimensionless coordinate in my fifth dimension. And so the two terms have to both be dimensionless. And it's actually kind of interesting. Now, remember that I defined G and F to be the overall low-energy coupling constant and the low-energy F constant, which I held fixed. That actually determines the mass scale, because that's what relates four-dimensional distance to this dimensionless distance in the metric. And so GF over 2 is going to be a typical mass scale of Kaluza-Klein modes in this kind of thing. OK. So are there questions about that? I know that went by fast, and you've got it in microscopic print, probably, on your copies. But are there any questions about the motivation and about how deconstruction has worked? It's the equivalence in the continuum limit of a latticized five-dimensional theory and the five-dimensional case. Okay? So, but the nice thing is this latticized theory I can think of as a purely four-dimensional theory with lots and lots and lots of factors. So I've reduced thinking about a five-dimensional theory to a four-dimensional theory, and at least for me, that's much more comfortable. Questions? Okay, so now we're ready to discuss the simplest Higgsless model. In fact, the model that I discussed last time is in this class, although I won't work out the correspondence in detail. You can find it in the literature. Let me consider a generalization. I said SU2 cross U1, the standard model, was just one SU2 group and one U1 group. But let me imagine putting a whole bunch of SU2s in the middle. So I have an SU2 to the n times U1 theory, okay? And I'm going to allow for arbitrary gauge coupling constants and arbitrary F constants. Now, at least naively, this theory has a chance to work because I have enough nonlinear signal model fields that I can give mass to all of the SU2 gauge bosons. I'm just going to have one U1 gauge boson left over because all of these nonlinear signal model fields break SU2 cross U1 to the n cross U1. Down to a single U1. So I'm going to have one massless gauge boson that's a U1 gauge boson left over. I'm going to associate that with the photon. I have yet to see whether I can actually get a light W and Z and heavy other states, but at least I can start with a massless photon. I have to tell you where I'm going to couple the fermions. Remember, when we have an extended gauge symmetry, the gauge charges of the fermions have to come from one of the original factor groups. I'm going to choose the charges to sit the fermions to get their SU2 charges from this SU2 group at the end, and their U1 charges from this U1 group at the end. In the five-dimensional language, that corresponds to saying fermions sit on brains at two ends of this interval. Now, if you think about that hard, that doesn't make an enormous amount of sense, because the left-handed fermions have both SU2 and U1 quantum numbers. The right-handed fermions have only U1 quantum numbers. So somehow the SU2 fermions are getting their quantum numbers from this guy and from this guy that seem, at least a priori, to be at different sites in theory space, and maybe different sites in real space. I'll come back to that. Nonetheless, if I can convince you that I can analyze this class of theories in detail without specifying what the G's and the F's are, I think I will have convinced you that I've done an infinite number of different theories all at once. I'm lazy, so I'd rather do an infinite number of theories at once rather than do them one at a time. Okay, and as I said, this is a generalization of the electroweak chiral Lagrangian to involving many others. In fact, if you look in the literature, it's related to a model of electroweak symmetry that's in the literature called breaking electroweak symmetry strongly, BESS, which was inspired by models of hidden local symmetry in QCP. So this kind of model, although we're coming at it from a five-dimensional point of view, deconstructed four dimensions, actually has a history in the literature. Except in that case, they were typically talking about only n was either 1 or 2. And we're going to be talking about the possibility of n being anything we want, as small as 1 or 2, but perhaps much larger. Now, it's important to remember that there need not be a simple relationship in the continuum limit between theory space and real physical space. When you go to the continuum limit, it reproduces some five-dimensional gauge theories, but you have freedom in how you choose to lay down these points in the fifth dimension. So in particular, you could imagine, suppose you had a theory which was a bunch of SU2s and a bunch of U1s, you could imagine taking the continuum limit so that the five-dimensional interval is here, but the moose actually winds around in the five-dimensional space. So that what you're actually describing in the continuum limit is a theory that, so this is, if you associate this with a single position in the fifth dimension, it actually has an SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge symmetry. So even though this moose looks like it's just a bunch of SU2s and a bunch of U1s in a line, it actually represents a five-dimensional SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge theory in the continuum limit. And this is how, if I put the fermions, say, to get their couplings here and here, their couplings all arise from one grain in the five-dimensional theory, even though, in theory space, those two lattice points are a very different situation, different points. Okay. So if you go and you look in the literature and look up Higgsless models in the continuum, you will find most of them are based on SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 and the bulk. And so it may not seem clear how what I'm talking about is related, but this. Now, I'm actually going to restrict my attention to the simplest moose without any of these U1s, just one U1. But it's, as I will discuss very briefly, or at least mention, you can generalize it to this case as well. Okay, are there any questions about that? Because now I'm actually going to do a calculation. I know this is unusual to do it. I mean, Hagiwara-san did a calculation yesterday in front of you. This doesn't usually happen at centers. Okay. Yeah.
In dimensional sequence logic, it starts from a larger group and turns down to the example group and to two and two.
So the question is the Higgsless model.
The larger group is a fifth one on group one.
Okay. So Higgsless models do take a larger group down to U1, but the character of the group changes. When you say it's a larger group, it's a gauge group in five dimensions. Right, so maybe it's an SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 gauge theory in five dimensions, which if you think about the gauge degrees of freedom, you have one four-dimensional gauge degree of freedom for SU2 cross SU2 cross U1 at every five-dimensional point. So it's a huge gauge group from a four-dimensional point of view. When we say it breaks down to a U1 gauge theory, we're talking about one four-dimensional unbroken U1 gauge theory.
Yes, yes. I mean, in five dimensions, there are the
yes.
So, that group is a gauge group.
So in five dimensions is a gauge boson.
Yeah. In SMT correspondence, so there will be vector meson. It's massive.
Correct.
So what's the gauge?
Okay. So the question is, where do the KK modes come from in this theory? Is that right?
Yes.
And actually, that's exactly what I'm going to next. But the KK modes correspond to diagonalizing the mass matrix with this extended gauge symmetry. Right, because I've got many, many, many gauge bosons in here, and I have a mass matrix that couples them together. I'm going to have to diagonalize that mass matrix. And so those diagonal states correspond to the KK modes. Good question. Other question? And so, as anticipated by the question, what we have to do in order to understand this theory is to actually diagonalize the mass matrix and compute the correlation functions that give rise to the scattering amplitudes of the fermions. And now, at first sight, that seems kind of impossible, but we do the obvious thing. We start by writing down what the mass matrix is. And I'm going to write down the mass matrix for this arbitrary model, and if you look at the neutral mass matrix, all of the T3 components here, for example, this is what it looks like. And at first sight, it looks like a complete and total mess, right? Because it involves, you know, these n plus 2 different couplings and n plus 1 F constants in this kind of a scenario, okay, in this kind of a matrix. But actually, if you think about the matrix more carefully, you realize that it's really a very special matrix. It only has entries along the diagonal, one entry on the superdiagonal, and one entry below on the subdiagonal, and that's it. Those three elements, those three diagonals are the only things that are populated. And that's because if you go back and you think about it, that's really because, in some sense, this is a discretized second derivative. Right, that's what we started with. That's why the deconstructed language works. Okay, so if I diagonalize this, I know I'm going to get a massless photon just from the gauge structure. And I assume that I'm going to get one light Z and some heavy Zs. Okay? Now, how do I get the charge gauge boson mass matrix? Well, the n plus one first coupling is zero. And if I restrict my attention by striking out the last column in the last row, that gives me the W mass matrix. Okay? And so that's what I'd like to understand. The electromagnetic coupling turns out this way, just from general properties of gauge symmetry. So what I'm going to do now is calculate a correlation function using this arbitrary mass matrix. Okay? So here we go. The correlation function that we need to evaluate is related to the propagator for all of these gauge bosons simultaneously. So it's related to 1 over q squared plus m squared, where this is the entire n plus 2 by n plus 2 dimensional mass matrix. Now, why is it a q squared plus m squared? We've done this in Euclidean space. So it'd usually be 1 over p squared minus m squared. I've just chosen to do it in Euclidean space for simplicity. Now, if I could compute the inverse of 1 over q squared plus m squared, I would be done. Because that would allow me to calculate the propagator. It would allow me to calculate, in particular, I know that the fermions only couple here and here. So if I calculate the 0, 0 inverse correlator, the 0 n plus 1 correlator, and the n plus 1 n plus 1 correlator, I'll be done. Because those are the only things that my fermions couple to. Is that part clear? Because it's crucial to the calculation. The fermions only couple at, let me go back and say it again. The fermions only couple here, and they couple here. So in principle, I could diagonalize it, calculate all the eigenvectors, compute the couplings of all the KK modes, all the fermions, and add them all up. But that amounts to simply calculating, oops, took the wrong direction. It amounts to simply calculating three different elements of the inverse matrix, 1 over q squared plus m squared. The 0, 0 element, the 0 n plus 1 element, and the n plus 1 element. Those are the three things I need. And I'm going to start, because it turns out this is the one that's related to S, I'm going to start by calculating the correlator between the T3 current for fermions, which comes from site 0, and the hypercharge current for fermions, which comes from site n plus 1. And what I want to convince you is that you can actually calculate this in full generality. The key is understanding what calculating it means. Because if you ask the question, can you write down this correlator in terms of these parameters, G0, F1, G2, G2, G3, F2, F3, the answer is no, of course you can. But that's not really relevant. That's not phenomenologically relevant. What's relevant phenomenologically is the spectrum of states, what the masses of all the Z and all its KK modes are, and what the masses of the W and all the KK modes are. And it turns out that you can calculate this matrix element in terms of those parameters. Okay? So let me walk you through it. So I'd like to compute the 0 n plus 1 matrix element of the inverse of this matrix. We all know how to calculate the inverse of the matrix. We first take the transpose of the cofactor matrix and then we divide by the determinant. So if we want to compute the 0 n plus 1 cofactor, we strike out the 0 row and the n plus first row, and we compute the determinant of what's left over. Now here the first miracle occurs, because if you strike out the first row and the last column, you get a matrix whose diagonal entries have no dependence on q squared whatsoever. So the determinant, and the lower diagonal is all zeros. Everything I have written here is zeros. So it's a matrix whose diagonal entries are constants. They're independent of q squared with nothing below the diagonal. But the determinant of such a matrix, I can imagine expanding it out by cofactors here, 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 here. The determinant of such a matrix is a constant. So the cofactor is a constant, independent of q squared. I haven't told you what the constant is yet, but it's a constant. So that means that this matrix element is a constant whose value is yet to be determined, divided by the determinant of the matrix, right? I need to divide by the determinant of this whole matrix. But the determinant of that matrix is nothing other than the product of q squared plus m squared for all the masses of all the KK modes, for all the masses of the all the eigenvalues of the neutral max matrix square. This is crucial. So let me pause for a minute. I've just computed for you the 0n plus 1 element of the general matrix here. But the key was understanding what I meant by compute. I didn't mean give you an arbitrary formula in terms of the input parameters. I'm instead giving you a formula in terms of the masses of the eigenstates that appear. But I even know more than that, because I know the residue of the pole at Q squared equals zero. Right? There's one massless state, that's the photon. There's one state I'm going to identify with the Z, and there's a bunch of higher mass states. But the residue of the pole at Q squared equals zero is electric charge. We know what the coupling of the photon is. And therefore, the residue of the pole at Q squared equals zero is E squared, so I actually even know what this constant is in terms of, in terms of the electric charge and all of the masses. Okay, and all of the other residues actually give me formulas that tell me what the couplings, the particular couplings to all of these states are, in principle. Okay? I don't need them, but in principle I can extract them from this one. So this is the sense in which you can do the computation in complete generality, okay, and rewrite the answer in terms of the spectrum of states that occur. Now, why is that useful? Well, if you go back, let's see, if you go back, I'd like to extract the S parameter. The S parameter, if you think about it for a moment, is related to the residue at Q squared equals the mass of the Z squared. The residue of what? Well, if I take the so this is written as T3 minus S squared Q. Remember, the charge is T3 plus Y. So I can write this numerator instead. I had charge here. I don't have charge. I can write this numerator instead as C squared I3 minus S squared Y. If I write Q as T3 plus Y and just use the fact that C squared plus S squared is 1, this is equal to C squared T3 minus S squared Y. So if I look at the cross term, T3 from one term and a Y from the other term, I just get an overall factor of C squared S squared, which is exactly what occurs here. And so if you work out what the residue, at the Z pole, what the residue of the T3Y coupler correlator is, which is what we just calculated, this 0n plus 1 correlator is nothing other than the T3 current with the hypercharge current. You can show that from our general formula, that's equal to minus E squared times 1 plus alpha S over 4S squared C squared. And it doesn't matter here. Professor Tanabashi pointed out quite correctly that in general you need to be careful what you mean by sine squared and cosine squared. But since this is already a small parameter, the differences between which definition of S squared and C squared you use in this term don't matter. So in general, the residue of the T3Y correlator at the Z pole is related to the value of S. But I can compute that directly from this form of the correlation function. It's just the residue of the pole at Q squared equals minus mz squared. Again, why minus mz squared? Because I've been perverse and worked in Euclidean using Euclidean momentum. So if I extract the pole at Q squared equals minus mz squared, this is it. So I now have a general formula that relates the value of S for the spectrum of KK modes in my theory, spectrum of neutral KK modes. Now, I'm interested in a case where the Z boson is much lighter than any of the KK modes, so I can expand this product out and keep only the leading terms, and I then get a very simple relationship that tells me that in this entire class of models, no matter how I adjust the Gs and the Fs and whatever, there's a relationship between the value of S and the spectrum of KK mesons corresponding to which are excitations of the Z. And the value of S is related to the inverse sum of squares of the masses of all the KK neutral resonance, period. In all of these models, it doesn't matter what coupling constants, what F constants, anything that I show. Well, what's the use of that? Oops, I've already done that. Well, remember that the whole point of the KK modes in this theory was to unitarize WW scattering. So we must have that the masses of these modes are bounded by something like a TV. So we have a lower bound, I'm sorry, an upper bound on the lightest KK meson that exists, which means we have a lower bound on S, which means S is greater than a half in all of these models, no matter what. So for this entire class of models that I just computed, no matter what you do, no matter how many different metrics you analyze, no matter how you let the coupling constant vary with position, you will always find that as long as you impose that the mass of the lightest KK mode is light enough to unitarize WW scattering, then S is larger than allowed by experiment. Period. Okay. So this happens in this entire class of models. Any questions about that? So we have about 15 minutes to resurrect these models. How can we generalize this? Well, you can generalize it by taking a chain of SU2s and a chain of U1s, and you can vary where the fermions get their SU2 or U1 quantum numbers. And we've looked at that entire class of models, and we've found that the same result applies. And I'm not going to go through that computation, but I'm going to show you a nice oscillator analogy for this mass matrix, which will also tell you in what cases you would expect to get light W's and Z's and much heavier resonances, which is one piece we don't have so far. And it turns out that there's a relationship between the mass matrix for this kind of a moose and the frequency of a coupled harmonic oscillator, which looks like this. And here's the relationship. If you simply look at the mass matrix that I wrote down before, you can show that that mass matrix corresponds to the frequency matrix for the normal modes of a coupled harmonic oscillator where the spring constants of the adjacent of the ones are related to F squared and the masses are related to 1 over G squared. And there's nothing terribly deep about that. It's because this was related to a discretized second derivative squared. And if you think about in an oscillator, what the potential energy is, it goes like k times the difference in position squared. Okay, so the potential energy function for this is related to the quadratic form, which has to do with the masses for this kind of a gauge, extended gauge model. So you can now understand, for example, how you could get a light W lighter than everything else. Well, the W corresponds, the charge gauge boson mass matrix corresponds to setting this coupling constant to zero. If you set this coupling constant to zero, it means you set the corresponding mass to infinity. That corresponds to attaching that end of it to a wall. So suppose you take a case in which this coupling constant is small, much smaller than all of these. Well, then that corresponds to a large mass here and light masses here. Then you would expect there to be one low frequency and therefore low mass resonance corresponding to adiabatic motion of this heavy mass where everything else moves adiabatically, and then a bunch of much higher frequencies where this is also fixed and these oscillate at higher energies in between. Okay? And we know actually how to compute how the mass of that lightest mode goes, because if you have springs in series, they have like resistors in parallel. So there's an effective spring constant, which is 1 over the sum of each of the k's, each of the spring constants. But if you translate that in terms of the electroweak theory, in terms of the Moose theory, that means that there's an effective spring constant. I'm going to call that spring, the F constant associated with that V, or 2 over V, is equal to 1 over the sum of the squares of the F constant. So this is what I said originally, that there's a sense in which there's a low energy F constant, which is related to the harmonic sum of 1 over the squares of all of the F constants. And we already know that the effective coupling constant is 1 over the sum of the squares of all of these. And so the lowest mode is K effective over M0. M0 is just this lightest 1 over G0 squared for this lightest coupling. So an approximate value for the mass of the W that you get is just G0V over 2, which is the usual formula. But now we can actually relate that directly to what happens when you have a Z boson. Because if you look at the neutral mass matrix, the analogous thing has Gn plus 1 small. So you now have two large masses and a bunch of small masses in between. And all of this structure is exactly the same as in the W mass matrix. Now let's think about the oscillator modes of this. Well, there's a translational mode for which there's no restorational force at all. That's the photon. So that's the zero mass photon. The next lowest mode is the breathing mode, where the two masses oscillate opposite one another adiabatically. And how is that mass going to work? Well, the effective spring constant is the same as the effective spring constant in the W case, because all of these Ks are exactly the same. But what changes is the mass. What's relevant for the mass of the breathing mode is the reduced mass. And 1 over the reduced mass is the sum over 1 over the masses of these two. And therefore, you immediately get, by translating this into the usual formula for the Z boson, that the mass squared of the Z boson has exactly this form, with G0 playing the role of the weak coupling constant and Gn plus 1 playing the role of hypersure. So there's a direct analogy between springs and these kind of movements. Now, I'm not going to go through it. Oh, there's actually one other thing, which I found amusing and I didn't know. There's a certain duality even in springs, and this duality maybe was superfluous to use that term, but if you think about just a single spring, omega squared is k over n, it's clearly invariant under the replacement k goes to 1 over m. That's trivial. If I replace k by 1 over m and m by 1 over k over m goes to k over n. But that means that this oscillator has the same frequencies as this oscillator. Okay? What's amazing is that actually happens in these coupled oscillators as well. This oscillator system has exactly the same frequencies as this oscillator system, and it's always true for all of the modes except possibly the zero mode. The zero mode doesn't correspond in the two, but all of the other modes always do. And it turns out that there's a natural field theoretic interpretation to this in the Moose model. You know that in a Toff-Feynman gauge, the masses of the Eaton-Goldstone bosons are exactly the same as the masses of the gauge bosons that are there. And it turns out that this dual Moose corresponds to the mass matrix of the Eaton-Goldstone bosons in the Toff-Feynman gauge. And there are only Eaton-Goldstone bosons for those masses that are those bosons that are massive. There are no Eaton-Goldstone bosons for the masses. And that's why the zero mode doesn't necessarily. If you put all of those things together, and I'm not going to go through it, you can show that you can, by looking at the cases in which you can look at this most general model, and you can show that if you have, if the spectrum looks like a photon, a light W and Z, and heavy states, then the same analysis applies. What you find is, instead of S, it's the parameter S hat that Barbieri defined that's always bounded in that case and is unfortunately too large. So what we've shown is that in this general class of models, you always get an S parameter which is too large, which would seem like I've wasted 50 minutes of your time getting to this point because I've just shown that none of these models work. But there's still one big assumption that's being made, and that is that the fermions get all of their SU2 charge from a single site in the deconstructed Moose, and all of their hypercharge from a single site in the deconstructed Moose. So that's the last thing that we need to discuss. And so I'm going to end then with a discussion of delocalized fermions. That is, you can imagine taking a Moose like this and having the fermions get their charges not from a single SU2, but from some combination of these SU2s. So here's the coupling that you would write down in the model. Now, if you think about that a minute, that doesn't quite make sense, because how is it possible for a single fermion to be charged under all of these different groups? What you really mean is that there are a bunch of different fermions, each of these different sites, and there's a fermion mass matrix that couples them together, just like there was a gauge boson mass matrix that couples the gauge bosons together. Then you have to diagonalize the fermion mass matrix, and you want to associate the lightest modes of the fermion mass matrix with the ordinary fermions that you see. And the lightest modes of the fermion mass matrix will have a wave function squared, which will have a distribution along these different sites. And if you then think about what the SU2 couplings for such an object is, it would look something like this. Okay? So delocalized fermions means that you're allowing, in the continuum language, you're also allowing the fermions to live in the bulk, not just on the bulk. How does this affect things? Well, the first thing that we did is just try a simple model. It's almost the simplest thing that you could do. And in this case, we only delocalized the fermions at one site, and we calculated it for a lot of different cases. And let me just show it to you graphically. If you look at the different correlation functions, and you take the ratio of the correlation functions to the standard model, you find that you can adjust the couplings in such a way that you always get values of the correlation functions which equal those of the standard model of tumor. That may not be so surprising. You have an extra parameter now, delocalization. Maybe you can adjust it, at least to make one of the precision electroweak parameters now. In fact, it's pretty easy to see that if you allow yourself the freedom to choose an arbitrary delocalization, you can always make all of the tree-level precision electroweak parameters vanish, or at least be very small. The point is, you can choose a delocalization so that the wave function squared of the fermion is proportional to the W wave function. Now, why might this be possible? Remember that the W wave function is the lightest eigenmode of a symmetric matrix. That means all of its values can be taken to be positive. It has no nodes in the quantum mechanics sense. Like the lowest, it's the same statement that the lowest state of a harmonic oscillator has no nodes. The lowest state of any self-adjoint operator has no nodes. Then I can imagine taking a wave function so that the wave function squared of the fermion is proportional to the W wave function. Well, then the coupling of one of the KK modes to the fermions is an overlap. Remember, the couplings in these models are overlaps between wave functions. It's an overlap between a KK wave function and the square of a fermion wave function. But if you choose the square of the fermion wave function to be proportional to the wave function of the lightest modes, well, the modes are all orthogonal to one another. And therefore, none of the KK modes couple to the fermions at all. And so the fermions only couple to the W and Z, and none of the higher modes at all. So the higher KK modes become fermiophobic, if you want, in this limit. In the fermiophobic limit, you can actually show that these parameters always vanish exactly to this order. And there's small residual isospin violating parameters, typically of order MW to the fourth over MZ to the fourth, or MW prime to the fourth. So suppress the higher order. And therefore, this is always acceptable in terms of tree-level precision electroweak. Okay, now, how is it then that you would actually see, how phenomenologically would you know that this might be a possibility? Well, we generalized this to this class of models, and in this case, we did the calculation of the continuum because it was simply easier to do. And what we calculated, as Hagiwara-san and collaborators have defined, we calculated the anomalous state boson couplings. Now, by delocalizing the fermions, you've changed the fermion couplings to the KK modes and the gauge bosons, but you've done nothing about changing the W couplings amongst themselves. Okay? So in this model, you can compute the size of corrections to the electroweak parameters. And let's see, do I have it in a simpler, okay. And you can find that delta G1Z is related to MW squared over MW prime squared. Okay, this is the form you would have expected. If you were able formally to take the limit MW prime goes to infinity, you should reproduce the standard model at tree level, and therefore the anomalous couplings must vanish. You expect them, therefore, to vary by 1 over M squared. And you can ask, how well are they measured right now? The precise measurements of the WWZ vertex give you this bound on delta G1Z. And so you get a bound on the KK mode, which instead of the TEV is about 500 GeV. And to my knowledge, this is the first kind of a model where this kind of constraint, the anomalous gauge boson coupling constraint, is the leading constraint on the model. Okay? Because you've eliminated all of the S and T. Typically, what happens in a Technicolor-like theory is Technicolor theories do give rise to anomalous gauge boson coupling, but they give rise to larger values, typically of S. And therefore, the models that you would rule out using anomalous gauge boson couplings are typically or three-point couplings are already ruled out in terms of the two-point. This can be parameterized in terms of the electroweak parameters that Tanabashi-san discussed, and in ideal delocalization, which was that taking the fermion wave function to proportional to the W wave function, you find that alpha 1, the thing's proportional to S, or L10 is zero, but all of the others that we have to do with the three-point couplings and the four-point couplings typically do get corrections. Okay, so let me conclude then. Higgsless models are an intriguing candidate, I think, to the solution to the puzzle of electroweak symmetry breaking. They are not a fundamental candidate in and of themselves, but in the context of the AES-CFT duality, they may be analog computers for calculating the effects of some strongly coupled conformal or nearly conformal field theory that's like Walker's method. Deconstruction gives a very convenient framework for studying these five-dimensional gauge theories as consistent effective theories. It also gives us a way of thinking about just four-dimensional theories, because you can think of a model with just a few sites, and that's a perfectly valid four-dimensional field theory. Professor Simmons will discuss such a toy model tomorrow. Higgs-less models with localized fermions, no matter what spatially dependent coupling or warping you choose, are phenomenologically not viable because the S parameter is too large. Delocalized fermions can yield viable models. Ideal delocalization in particular, in principle, can always be chosen, which gives vanishing and very small electroweak parameters, in which case very small corrections to four fermion coupling, four fermion processes, and therefore the best limits come from triple gauge boson vertices, and they're typically of order 500 to 700 GeV. Of course, what would remain to be answered, it would be nice to come up with a model where it was natural for this ideal delocalization or something like it to occur. As far as we can tell at this point, we don't have any examples of that, but this is an existence proof of how such a thing might possibly arise. Thank you very much.
Okay, according to the schedule, we have for half an hour of discussion, a question, right? Because oh no, sorry, it's 10 minutes.
Oh, good, go ahead.
Okay, question.
I was told no one ever was mad when a talk went too short as opposed to too long.
Is there any new CP violations associated
with this theory? Okay, so the question is, are there any new CP violations as sources in this theory? Yes and no, or rather no and no. No, at the level that we've analyzed the theory, we haven't even included realistic generation of fermion mass matrices, so we can't address the question yet of CP violation of fermion. In the model that Professor Simmons will discuss tomorrow, that's one of the things that we can start to see. In that simple case, there's no more CP violation a priori than there would be in the naive CKM model. On the gauge boson sector, it's CP invariant.
That is because
no, it's just because the tree level, the gauge interactions themselves, the nonlinear sigma model at the order that we computed, that we're using it, and the gauge interactions are that Lagrangian is just CP invariant. You could imagine CP violation by trying to put in WW dual terms, for example, for each of those, but those would typically not give rise to any CP violation any larger than electroweak instant bonds, so they'd be tiny.
Okay. Any other question? Actually, I have two. The first is from the delocalized fermion, that means the KK mode prefer to appear in the Gauge boson interaction, but not fermion, right?
Correct.
So it's a fermion phobia scenario.
Correct.
So that means in the future phenomenology study, we can, we just, this new phenomenon only appear at the WW pattern.
Correct. In this limit, that's correct.
Okay. And then the second question is, you use the deconstruction method to construct the fixed dimension, right?
Yes.
Did someone investigate to use this method to construct from the three-dimensional theory to the fourth-dimensional theory, or from the lower, for example, one-dimension theory to the two-dimensional theory, something like that.
Yes, but not. Let's see. Long ago, there was an attempt, and I don't actually know how it. I assume if it turned out well, we'd know. But there was an attempt to reconstruct four-dimensional gauge theories by taking two-dimensional gauge theories and piecing them together, because two-dimensional gauge theories are completely solvable. But then you have to add the interactions amongst the two-dimensional gauge theories that then give rise to the three- and four-dimensional theory. And there were two possibilities. One was that you could actually do something analytic, and I think that was just not true. The other was that maybe that could be used in numerical simulations, and I don't think in the end it was chosen, it was seen to have any advantages, because while it was possible maybe for the gauge sector, I don't think it gave any advantages to the fermion sector, which is what in lattice gauge theory is often the problem. So I don't think in the end those techniques have worked. Now in some sense, formally, what people are doing in lattice gauge theory is taking a bunch of zero-dimensional gauge theories and piecing them together to form a four-dimensional gauge theory. And so in some sense, that does happen all the time.
Okay, thank you. So any other questions? Okay, if no, we have a...
Okay, thanks for the speaker here.